Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Speaking of Translation. I'm Eve Baudot.
And I'm Corinne McKay. Thanks for joining us.
For today's episode, we would like to thank a listener whose name is Mireille, you know who you are, for suggesting today's topic, which is translation technique and how to actually do a translation, which actually, surprisingly enough, is a topic we've never addressed before.
Yeah, so Mireille contacted me about a month ago, and here's what she said. My question is how to improve your translation in order to make it flowing instead of literal. Where to stick to the text and where to take some liberty? What tips would you give? And since this is an often overlooked topic amid all of our other topics about marketing and business development and professional development, here we go. So thanks a lot, Mireille, for suggesting this.
Yeah, thank you, Mireille. It's very exciting and it's going to be a fun topic, I think. So before we get into that, though, this is Eve. We wanted to give you guys an update on what's been going on with us since our last episode. I wanted to say that, not to date this episode, but right now we're recording in the middle of the coronavirus crisis. And so what's changed since last time is that right now my personal motto is stay safe and stay sane. And so I know we all
I
say
love
stay
it.
safe, yeah, but
I
I've been
love
adding
it.
stay sane because we're all confined and we want it to be as positive as it can be anyway. So yeah, take the precautions you need to keep yourself and your family safe, but don't neglect the things that you need to stay sane in this topsy-turvy confined world we're now living in. And hopefully when you hear this episode soon at some point, that'll all be over. So maybe this will be old advice. Yeah, and I appreciate those of you who are listening to this podcast and have made a choice to let us share our thoughts and ideas with you during this time and really at any time. So thank you. And my personal updates are that the second language challenge group that I did for Corinne's training for translators, right, Corinne? Was very successful. It was really fun. We all focused on how ch did different daily challenges on how to improve and get closer to our second language or third language or fourth language.
And people loved it. You're too modest to say that, but I will say, having read the participant feedback, people loved
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was super fun to do, actually. I kind of missed them doing the recordings in my
it.
library after it was over. So that was great. Another thing I wanted to say was the book club that I started that I mentioned at the end of 2019 and that we've mentioned a couple times since then is going strong. And if anybody wants to join, we're having a fun time. There's over 200 people involved in it who signed up, who get the emails, and who either come on to Slack and discuss the different books you're reading with us, or we also have Zoom meetings. And so people, if you prefer that kind of meeting, you can do that too. So we have over 200 members, like I said, with over 30 people who read and speak over 32 languages. So that's kind of cool. And just to give you guys a little flavor of that, we read focus on books in translation. And so the books we've read so far were originally written in English and Japanese. And our third book is going to be is a book that was originally written in Spanish. So
Cool.
yeah. And then I am going to be developing a course for bilingual families, and that's in the early stages. But since a lot of you listeners are my favorite people, I wanted you to be some of the first to know.
Oh, that's awesome.
And also that holds me accountable, doesn't it? And so there'll be more information on that to come, but I'm developing a course for bilingual families, kind of sort of in the vein of the challenge, but a little bit different. So,
Very
and
cool.
then on the work front, I've been translating some business case studies for a client that's always a really wonderful client to work with. And it's a mixture of marketing and business texts, and that's fun. And then I'm also working on some long-term projects, like many of us are, that never get done, whatever those might be. So yeah, what's your update, Corinne?
Yeah, so I guess a couple of things, mostly hoping that all of our listeners, I'm going to use your saying, are staying safe and staying sane in this crazy time. Hopefully, if you're listening to this episode retroactively, like a year from now, this will all be a memory. But if you're listening in real time, we hope that you're staying as physically and mentally healthy as possible. I've been keeping pretty busy with work. I had two big translation projects scheduled before the COVID crisis went down, and they are both happening. But my interpreting work has dropped off really almost completely. The Colorado courts initially moved some stuff to the phone, and now most of the courthouses are shut down. So when I thought, what's something I could do with this extra time to help? I launched a free MOOC style session of my online course, Getting Started as a Freelance Translator. So I thought maybe 75 or 100 people would register.
And in
So,
true MOOC fashion.
right, in true MOOC fashion, keeping the M in massive,
Right.
900 people
Woo.
signed up. And the only reason it stopped there was because I cut it off at 900 and just thought, like, I can't do this.
Wow,
But I
so
wanted to
some.
give a huge shout out to the group of 18 mentors, including Eve, who, when I saw those 900 people, I thought, there is no way I can handle this myself because we have a Slack group that everyone gets to participate in. So 18 amazing, generous, experienced freelance translators, including Eve, stepped up to the plate and have been really busy answering everyone's questions. So that's been a lot of fun lately.
Yeah, so it was fun. I know the number, and I saw it in different emails from Corinne being recruited as a mentor, as the numbers would go up and up and up.
I know that
So
first I said, you won't believe it, more than 500 people have signed up, 700. And then really, I think now it's something like 905. And the only reason that it stopped there is because I just thought, like, this is going to become unmanageable. Even with the number of mentors that we have, it won't be doable to answer people's questions and things like that. So I cut it off at 905.
Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you from the industry for doing that, Corinne. So let's dive into today's topic, which again is translation technique. And I thought it'd be good if we could each give our take on Mireille's question, which was how to make a translation sound natural instead of sounding like a translation, and how much to step away from the source text without stepping so far that you're basically rewriting the document. So I'll talk about that first, and then I'll pass it off to you, Corinne. So my first line of attack, in my approach to having a natural translation is to have a ref to have refined my workflow and approach, and so to kind of tackle it at least in the first line from a logistical point of view. So I want to talk about a little bit what I do, like when I get a translation and how I approach that. So when I receive a translation, and it'll be interesting, some of you will think, yeah, that's what I do, or some of you will be thinking, I don't do that at all. I mean, it's interesting to kind of compare, and I'd be interested to hear what other people do. So the first thing I do with that end goal in mind is I read the source text. So if it's short, I read it in its entirety, and if it's long, I read parts of it and skim or scan it as, you know, scan it as appropriate. So my goal in doing that is to understand, you know, the tone and the register of the text, so I can keep that in mind as I'm thinking how close or how far away I want to get from the original text and get me in the right mindset. And so that's also to identify any particular challenges that the translation contains, so that I have them in mind as I begin my work, and you know, how am I going to address them? That's kind of working in my mind and in the back there. So I also get all my resources ready. That I identified for this particular project. So any of my usual resources for the project, like online dictionaries or my iPad dictionary or hard copy style guides or online style guides, dictionaries, whatever. Plus then any special things I think I might need for a particular project. So for example, it could be, you know, in addition to what I normally would use, also I might use a computer topics lexicon or a specialized dictionary on cooking terms or whatever. You know, that might not apply to everything, but applies to this particular project. Then of course I'm kind of simplifying things. I start translating. So I translate the entire document and then I take a breather. And so that breather could be, you know, overnight if I have time, or it might just be 3 hours, but I walk away from the computer or do something different before I set out to do my full self-edit. And so I'm trying to distance myself from the work so that my natural you know, my natural, like Mireille was saying, my more natural way of speaking is or writing is going to be imposed on it, as opposed to just still being kind of stuck into the original language too. Does that make sense? And so so I have, so when I start doing this full self-edit, then as the next step, I have a check. I actually have a checklist of things that I verify. But it's like a standard checklist that I use that I modify slightly for each job, but a standard checklist I use. Which includes mechanical things like punctuation. So, you know, making sure it conforms to English rules and not French ones. That's much more natural, because I think when we're kind of stuck and going quick too, sometimes it's easy to miss adapting that kind of thing in translation. But I think that errors in formatting and punctuation that hark back to the original really scream translation.
Like the space before the exclamation point or the
Yeah.
chevron marks instead of quotation marks or things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, just really, really simple things that we can do to make it not seem like a translation.
Yep.
Yeah, which aren't super, you know, which may not seem super sophisticated, but it comes across, even if someone reading it doesn't know that's because it was a translation, it seems odd to them, you know, mm-hmm. a native English speaker. So, and another example is that seems to come up often, kind of depending on how the source text was written, but like one thing I do is I really ruthlessly edit any of the extra "thes" that can sneak through in English from the French. So, you know, as we all know, giving an example for those who don't speak French and English, if translate French and English, is that, you know, French uses a definite article much more than we would naturally do in English. So sometimes when you're translating it, you're not really seeing that because you're kind of looking at it mm-hmm. as an individual piece, right? And then I just feel like, okay, that's one thing is ruthlessly editing your own work and mm-hmm. edit out these small but telling items that have sneaked in, you know, during the first pass.
Mm-hmm.
So then, once I've done my edit pass, I perform another one that I learned from Corinne. I don't know how you use it in your own workflow, but I do the auditory pass. So mm-hmm. I from almost all my work now, I have the computer read my own translation out loud to me. And for my family sanity, I do put on a headset.
Yeah, I do it with earbuds, but I would literally, I am not a particularly gifted editor, and I would be dead without proof listening. So we can put in the show notes the link to, I wrote a couple of blog posts about text to speech, which is where the computer reads the translation to you. But yeah, that it is such a lifesaver for me.
Yeah, and I think that this kind of goes back to when different times if you'll read people like, how do you proof your own work? How do you edit your own work? There's different, I'm not going to talk about that too much, but like people will say things like print it, you know, do different things. But to me, this is a really great way to kind of follow that same idea, but to get this input in a different fashion. So I'm not reading mm-hmm. it. I mean, I kind of, my eyes sometimes do follow it, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
But you're getting input into it into a different fashion. So for me, which is auditory. So for me, I catch odd phrasing, you know, more easily because I'm like, oh, that sounds bizarre, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes actually I should add in too, if it's a script, something that's written as a script, I actually will read it out loud in my own voice too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yep. So I just thought of that as I was reading here. I think even if it's not necessarily something that anyone else would have noticed, you know, maybe I'll catch odd phrasing, but I also just may make improvements that I like better. You know, that weren't necessarily not natural, but I think, oh, that's even better now, you know.
Yep.
So it helps me catch typos. It helps me catch repeated words, other small typographical errors, but just hearing it out loud. So the basic thing, though, I think of relating back to Marie's question is it helps me to be more detached in reviewing my own work. And you kind of hear it as if you're a third party. So it's more mm-hmm. easy. It's more easy for me to correct it, easier for me to correct it with my native ear mm-hmm. rather than being so focused on the source text. So that's one thing. So I may do the out loud reading several times or just maybe certain sections. Like I think, well, I rewrote that section a lot. So now I want to hear it again, you know, the audio version mm-hmm. of it. And so, and that also of course depends on how long the text is. Like if it's, you know, 50,000 words, I probably can't do that, you know, to every single section of it.
mm-hmm.
But I might, if it's a novel, then I might do that. Even if it's long, you know, cause it's particularly important, for the flow of it. So in addition, of course, I always do a spell and grammar check at multiple stages since I could touch the text multiple times. Because I don't know if other people do that, but I feel so OCD. I just feel like, oh, my God, what if I accidentally inserted a mistake that one time I made this correction?
Yeah.
And so I'll do that multiple times. And sometimes, like, we all make fun of, you know, Microsoft or different grammar stuff that seems really basic. But once in a while, I still do like to do that because it'll catch something small that I did miss, you know. And I'll think, oh, okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
Even though a lot of them you ignore. So anyway, the point of all this is that I think having a specific approach, like a workflow approach, helps you to be able to focus on various aspects in an orderly way that help you improve the natural sound of your translation. And like I said, what other people do may be different than what I do, but I think there has to be some kind of method, you know, to the madness. And then it helps you to focus really on getting that natural sounding translation product. And there's one thing I wanted to add about that. You know, there's lots of other things we could talk about. And I think we could talk about this topic for days and days and days as I talk
certainly.
On and on.
Yeah. Yeah.
But another thing, one other aspect I wanted to mention specifically was, one of the things I always emphasize in my training on maintaining your second language, which also relates to natural sounding translations, is that we all must focus in a general way on cultural issues and being culturally fluent as well. This is something that that has to become a part of us, I think, as translators, and we have to continually focus on that, learning about the culture, you know, learning about that culture that we're translating, and that learning process can never stop. So we don't just know the language, but we have to know the culture too. And so, you know, so that we can understand things that are idiomatic, but then translate them idiomatically and naturally into their target language. And so an example I have is just the other day I was explaining to my mom, who is monolingual, about the idea of April Fools that exists in France too, you know, when the idea of playing tricks on people on the 1st of April, but it's slightly different. And I was telling her that people say Poisson d'Avril instead of April Fools.
Right. April so fish.
Yeah. So, exactly, so they're right. So obviously we need to know, if that was in a translation, that really doesn't mean in English fish of April.
Yeah.
But we would translate it in a way that's understandable and makes sense. And so that's just like an obvious thing. But I think that, what I thought of too, thinking about it more deeply, was that the translation might even vary, because just because someone speaks English, you know, it depends on where the target is, because maybe not everyone who speaks English around the world celebrates April Fools. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like if I were translating it, that's what I would say, but maybe he's someone else in a different culture for a different context wouldn't. So anyway, so those are some of my thoughts. And like I said, I'm sure we could talk for days on this, but I'll be quiet now so that Corinne can give us her take on that.
That was really interesting. So I guess, and I should say, we didn't compare notes before this, but it worked out well that you talked about sort of the practical points, and I'm going to talk maybe a little more about the conceptual, my conceptual take on this. So my all-time favorite quote about translation in general is from Edith Grossman, who's a Spanish to English literary translator who is still alive and living in New York, and who I came to know and love for her English translation of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's book, Love in the Time of Cholera, which I've probably read, no joke, 10 times.
I'm
a rereader.
We never talked about this before either, but that's one of my favorite books too. I was just talking to one of my sons about it, telling him he should read it.
No wonder we get along so well. But yeah, I've, no joke, probably read her translation of Love in the Time of Cholera 10 times. And when she was giving a speech, this was back in 2003 at Penn, the, you know, authors' rights and translation rights organization, and she was giving a speech about that translation, and she said, and I have this quote up on my desk at my co-working office, fidelity is surely our highest aim, but a translation is not made with tracing paper. So first of all, you have to be old enough to know what tracing paper is. if you're too young for tracing paper, you can imagine what it is.
Look it up, yeah.
Yeah, look it up. But I love that quote because I think it points to the tension in what we do as translators, in that you're always sort of riding this line between, you know, I want to express exactly what the author said, especially if, as a, you know, Nobel Prize winning author, they presumably agonized over every word, and the fact that that's often impossible to do because of the differences between the two languages, and that what you're really trying to do is inspire the same reaction or emotion in the target language reader as the original author did in the source language. So if I had to answer Mireille's question in one sentence, I think that Edith Grossman quote would be it. So here's an example that gets into the more practical realm, would be the use of passive versus active voice. So for example, in a lot of European corporate documents, you'll see tons of passive voice, like the company is pleased to announce its first quarter earnings, or the CEO sends you her warmest wishes for a happy new year, which sound very impersonal and stilted in English, because we would say, you know, here at Apple, we're pleased to announce our first quarter earnings. Or, as CEO of Apple, I send you my warmest wishes for a happy new year. Actually, Tim Cook would say something even less formal than that. You know, happy new year from all of us
from
at Apple.
Yeah.
Right. So right there, when you talk about, you know, Mireille's way of putting that was taking some liberty, I guess. And I mean, the interesting thing is, I once actually heard a translator say, no one forces French people to write in the passive voice. They do it because they think it sounds good. They do it because they think it's appropriate to the situation. But my take would be, if you reflect that in the translation, then I think you're making a mistake, because it inspires a different reaction mm-hmm. or emotion in a U.S. reader. You know, that if Tim Cook issued a press release and said, you know, the corporation is pleased to announce its first quarter earnings, you'd think, like, what is he trying to hide? Mm-hmm. That sounds really, you know,
well, I think too, it's interesting
distant
that.
And impersonal. Yeah.
And another example is like a French, or and I'm sure other languages too, closing in a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Where in French it's very, can be very formal, but
it's like four sentences long.
Yeah, l'expression de mes,
right, mes sentiments les plus distingués or whatever.
Whatever. And then in English the translation is sincerely.
Right. Best regards.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So I think one practical tip I would give people is, whatever your source language is, I think you want to watch out for the sort of specific grammatical constructions that, if they are translated literally, sort of scream, this is a translation. So, for example, with like the passive voice example I gave, another one would be the use of the expression of the versus using a possessive. So in French, like probably all Romance languages and other languages too, you can't make a word possessive by adding the equivalent of apostrophe yes. So instead of saying Corinne's computer, you have to say the computer of Corinne. And of course, no one would write the computer of Corinne, but people do write a lot of things like the board of the corporation, the meaning of the law, the purpose of the discussion, instead of the corporation's board, the law's purpose, the law's meaning, the discussion's purpose. And that's a little thing, but trust me, when you overuse of the, I mean, it's not like we never say it in English.
Right, right.
But when
it's real specific,
every single,
it's real stylistic.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. But when every single possessive is translated as of the, that's something that makes it scream out it's a translation. So I think mm-hmm. I would say, look for in your source and target languages, what are those things that sort of scream like this is a translation, and learn ways to work around those in a more natural way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another thing I was thinking that we could talk about was Mireille's question about how much can we step away from the source text? Like, when is it okay to not translate literally at all and basically rewrite something or change an idea or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that depends a lot on what the client's goals are and who the audience is and what kind of translation it is. So, for example, I'm not going to veer much from the original when translating instructions for a request for proposal, as for an example, as any deviation, you know, from that, like, oh, I want to get creative, could cost my client who's bidding on this, you know, multi-million-dollar construction project, for example, millions of dollars, right? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, I think when things are, when the actual source text itself is more creative or artsy, this could vary. So, an example I have is, last year, I translated a little novel from French into English in which the main character was an American caterer living in New Jersey. So it was written in French, but none of the characters weren't French at all.
Right. Oh, wow.
So that caused some kind of funny different differences. The American caterer was living in New Jersey. And in the French version, the caterer mentioned verrine several times. So verrine is a type of hors d'oeuvre, like that's a savory and it's served in a little glass. So my reading that just really jumped out at me, and the person who hired me to do the translation was saying, no, we want to leave that. And I thought, well, you know, some high-level American chef maybe serves verrines at a fancy restaurant, I guess. I don't know if people even know that word.
Yep.
Yeah, but I was like, but in this context of this specific story, trust me, an American caterer wouldn't have used this word. And it was kind of jarring, you know, in the reading along in English. And so I discussed it with the client and replaced it with the term souffle, which has nothing to do with verrine.
Oh, interesting.
But the item in the case, you know, wasn't crucial to the story. It was just she was talking about some food or whatever. And so anyway, so we switched it out in that case. Then in another place in the novel, we didn't actually, you know, how we always think to ourselves, like, we want to be consistent. We have to translate the same thing consistently throughout the novel, throughout the text. But in this case, another place where the word verrine appeared, it really was talking about, I mean, the idea was that somebody was nervous and they were stacking cups. And so it would have been weird to say souffle again, you know, which usually we want to stick with the same translation. So we used serving cups because the idea was that the character was making a nervous gesture. So we didn't even keep the same translation throughout the novel. It just depended on the context. But verine in either case was weird in English. So, and there was no true translation for that. So I think to me, the idea was to get across that the character was nervous and to adapt it, the text so that it was smooth reading by an American reader and that they didn't think about it as something weird, you know? And then I wanted to say too, in the book club, actually, we just finished reading the book called Convenience Store Woman, which was translated from Japanese into many different languages. And so it's been really fun in the book club to talk about the differences between like the Spanish translation, the French translation, the English translation, the Japanese original, where these kind of issues come up a lot too. So I thought that's pretty interesting. You know, this book that's been translated and is being read all over the world. So I think that the broader issue is if you translate something literally, but it loses its meaning in the target language, then that approach doesn't make any sense or it seems jarring. So our role as translators is to get the same meaning across, and the way to get there may be to deviate from the source language in a way that speaks to the target audience more clearly, you know, considering their cultural and linguistic background. So that are my thoughts on that. So Corinne, what do you think?
Yeah, so I agree with everything you said, and my take would be that the more subtle the reference in the source text is, the more you may just have to come up with your own solution. So here's an example. Years ago at the ATA conference for the French division, we had as a guest speaker an incredible French to English literary translator named Sandra Smith, who won basically every literary translation prize out there for her translations of the novels of a French World War II era author named Irène Némirovsky. And her, Némirovsky's books are really, really packed with sort of emotional undertones and, you know, secret relationships between people and things like that. And some of that is, and I know someone said, people say like, nothing is untranslatable, but some stuff is. So here's an example, or impossible to translate literally. So here's an example that Sandra Smith gave in a talk I heard, was a scene where you have these two characters, a man and a woman, who are falling in love with each other, but no one is supposed to know, and they don't even admit it to each other or possibly themselves yet. And in the French version, the way that Némirovsky conveys that is that they're addressing each other as vous, with the formal form of address, and one of them slips and calls the other tu, the informal form of address, and then she corrects herself. I believe it's the woman, and she says something like, avec toi, oh, excusez-moi, avec vous. And in English, really, there's no way to translate that because we don't have formal and informal forms of address. And like, you could use last name versus first name, but they're already on a first name basis. So Sandra told me that she got permission from the publisher to rewrite that sentence so that one of the characters touches the other one. So it says something like, you know, she let her hand rest on his shoulder a little too long, or something like that, so that you get what's going on, but it's not like the translator being like, oh, and by the way, they're in love, you know, that it is also this sort of subtle thing in English. So an example I thought of from my own work is from a nonfiction book translation that I did a couple of years ago. There were a couple of issues that came up with very specific cultural references. So the author of the book was Swiss, and Francophone Swiss culture is really, really specific. There's about 2 million French speakers in Switzerland, which by comparison is about the same population as Manhattan. So it would be like if the island of Manhattan, the borough of Manhattan, had like their own language. Not that no one else speaks French, but there's a lot of things that are sort of specific to Swiss French. Yeah. Right, in jokes, exactly. So there were, one I remember was that the author's a mountain climber, and he's talking about some piece of news in the mountaineering community. And what he was trying to say was like, you'd have to have been living under a rock to not have heard about that. But instead, he used the name of a really, really tiny village up in the mountains. Like, only people who live in this tiny village, they're the only ones who haven't heard about this. So it's like as if someone in the U.S. said, you know, you'd have to be from like rural North Dakota not to know that this was going on. And in the translation, we sort of struggled with like, do you just leave it? You know, knowing that no one except Swiss French speakers are going to get it, but people could look it up. Or do you footnote it? Or do you rewrite it and say something like, you'd have to be living under a rock not to know about that? So I think that that kind of goes back to the Edith Grossman thing. Like the goal is fidelity to the source document, but you can't do that by just doing like source word equals target word. So Eve, here's a question for you. How do you think your approach to translation technique changes depending on what you're translating? So I think of you as a particularly like broad spectrum translator, and I mean that in a positive way, like someone who you have specializations, but your specializations are pretty diverse, and you've translated everything from like software documentation to market research to books about nocturnal animals. So can you tell us a little bit across that spectrum about how this approach might change?
Thanks for that question. So circling back to what I said earlier, I think these types of translations can take totally different approaches. So while even with software documentation, you don't want to translate totally literally, right? But you do want to stay much closer to the original. You want it to be easily readable and naturally understandable for your target audience. So again, of course, in that, even with software or software documentation, I want to be sure to use, you know, the correct target language constructions, grammar rules, and I'm going to veer from the source sentence structure and terminology when appropriate. And also, I want to avoid keeping false friend terminology, because we have all seen that sometimes where I can't think of an example right now, but we're laughing our heads off because it's a similar word, but it means something totally different, right? So it sounds the same. But I think that by its nature, you know, this type of subject matter with technical manuals, it's much drier than the content of even market research, and definitely much drier than the content of a children's book, right? So, in market research, for example, somebody's response to a survey might use trendy abbreviations, and you have to know what those mean to find the equivalent in English. For example, somebody may write MDR or MDR, you know, which in French, you know, because people put all these, the market research is so funny. People put all these weird, funny stuff, you know, and so that's totally, you know, especially because they're often writing on their phones, answering these surveys and different stuff, that they put really informal things. So somebody might write that MDR, which basically means, you know, and literally in French means died laughing, which I think we could say that in English, right? We could say, oh,
Right,
I
I
died
was
laughing when you said blah, blah, blah. But
right.
in this particular context, the translation probably would really be LOL, which
Right,
is,
or ROFL, like rolling on the floor laughing. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that we'd actually probably say LOL in English. Yeah.
Yeah, like we wouldn't say, oh, I wouldn't write out in the translation, he said, I died laughing. You know, I
Right.
mean, even
You
though,
just write back LOL. Yeah.
like that's kind of correct, but not really because of the context. And so, and just like we said, laughing out loud, just LOL for laughing out loud in English. And then another example related to this exact phrase, LOL, is that my younger son, who's bilingual and who lives in the US, even though he speaks French fluently, he wanted to say LOL to his French cousins. And he made up the abbreviation, which he made up was RTF, which to him meant rire très fort,
Oh my gosh, I love that.
which to him means like laugh very, very much or
Right,
whatever.
laughing really hard.
And so he had, and so he wasn't even aware at that point that MDR already existed in common use. Like there was an equivalent of that. But so his cousins had a good laugh at that, and they all actually still say RTF,
Oh my gosh,
kind of
FTF. That's so funny.
as an in joke to be funny. But just going back to that idea where his translation was too literal, and he wasn't actually aware of what was really in use, right? So it sounded funny and awkward in French, and it's still like this big joke in our family. So anyway, yeah. And then
Cool.
for children's books, I think in that particular case, it's really important to be aware of, you know, the actual children's literature in your target language and what's accepted. Even though there's, you know, it's a creative medium, so there's lots, probably, you know, give and take. There's still certain things that are accepted or not accepted within that medium in the target culture. And you need to be aware of, you know, how different concepts can vary from culture to culture too. So an example, I know that Corinne, I don't remember if we've ever discussed this on the podcast, but I know we've discussed it personally before, is a French children's book that I have And in the picture, in the book, the family's eating dinner, and there's a clock on the wall that shows it's 8 p.m. with the little kids.
And the kids are like 2 and 4.
Yeah.
And they're sitting in, and like,
right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. So I just think like culturally, we wouldn't, that would be weird, because in the U.S., no kid would normally eat it. Maybe now with all this, you know, the confinement
right.
going on.
But like American preschoolers go to bed at 7:30.
Yeah,
so they eat
yeah.
dinner at like 5:30 or 6.
Right,
they don't,
right.
American preschoolers do not eat dinner at 8.
Right, yeah, so stuff like that. And then I think too, even just for educational books, you know, maybe for educational curriculum, you know, there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed to make things more natural. Since educational, just the whole approach to education and different curricula, they vary so widely from country to country. So just that all of these types of things have to be taken into account and addressed in a way that's satisfactory to you as a translator, to the client, to meet their specific goals, and why are they translating or adapting this specific content. And of course, it also has to be acceptable to the end user of the, what I'm calling the translation product, you know, the translation mm-hmm. itself, and the end user is going to be the reader.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So my question for you, Corinne, on that is, I know that you translate a lot of international, for a lot of international development clients, and they may use their documents with different audiences, and they have also different purposes sometimes. It differs from the mainstream business clients, how they might use their documents. So what's your approach in that particular instance?
Yeah, so even if you don't do international development translation, I thought this might point out sort of the specifics of working in a sector that has like its own vernacular. So you can, I think, translate this to other areas too. So I know, Eve, I know you deal with this too, because we have a couple of mutual clients. So feel free to add your uh-huh. thoughts as well. So I'd say two things I thought of are international development clients and international organizations in general tend to use what you might call UN speak, United Nations speak, which is sort of its own brand of mm-hmm. English that is often a bit inscrutable even to native English speakers. But you have to sort of roll with it when that is your target audience. So a sort of microcosm example I thought of is the term focal point, which in UN speak is a person. It's what you call a person who is like the key contact or resource person for a specific thing. Like this person serves as the IT focal point for our department. Means it's the person you go to in that department if you have a technology question. So I think that points to the fact that when you translate for a sector that has its own lingo, you need to use that mm-hmm. because that's what your readers are used to. And I also think that international development is one sector, although surely not the only one, where you are translating for a lot of non-native English speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So
point, yeah.
you want to use plain language whenever possible. And avoid the sort of creative turns of phrase. So one that could be confusing. So I think one thing is Americans write with, and maybe other countries too, but certainly Americans use sports metaphors. US English speakers use sports metaphors a lot. And the hard part is those are something that can make your translation not sound like a translation, which is good,
mm-hmm.
but when you're writing for non-native English speakers, it can also make it impossible to understand, which is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I know a lot of my international development clients use English as a sort of culturally neutral language at the office. So they might have people from, you know, German-speaking Switzerland, French-speaking Switzerland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy. So they just speak English at the office, even though it's no one's native language,
mm-hmm.
To avoid, you know, choosing something else. So let's take an expression like knocking it out of the park, which in US English means that in a baseball game, the batter hits the ball so far that it goes out of the baseball stadium and over the fence, so or into the stands where the spectators are sitting, so that they get to run around the bases as slowly as they want because it's such an amazing hit that it literally went out of the baseball park.
Mm-hmm.
So in something like web copy or a press release for the US, something like that could be great because that's an expression that no one but a fluent native English speaker would use. So it certainly does not sound like a direct translation from, you know, German or something. But let's say in international development, a lot of your audience is going to be people who are not native English speakers and are going to think, what on earth does that mean? Knocking what out of what park? So you actually want to avoid those types of expressions and use plain language, like say, this initiative was extremely successful, instead of saying the marketing team knocked it out of the park, you know, as we might say in something that we want to sound sort of colloquial in US English.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you have thoughts on that, on those, Eve, since you translate for some of those clients too.
Yeah, no, I like that. And I like the point, just the point that you made, really the bigger point, I think, the upper level point is that it really does go back to who exactly is your audience, like what's going to be the natural or appropriate for that audience. So yeah, thanks for those ideas. Well, I think we've come to the end of our podcast episode today, and thanks for everyone for joining us, and especially again to our listener Mireille for suggesting this topic. So if you're listening and you have a topic you'd like us to address in a future episode, you can reach us at speakingoftranslation@gmail.com, all one big word, or you can leave a comment on our website, speakingoftranslation.com.
And just a reminder that if you don't yet subscribe to us in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, what are you waiting for? Especially now, you're quarantined. You've got the time.
Get to it.
Yes. Subscribe right now so that you never miss an episode, or you can listen whenever you want at our website, speakingoftranslation.com. Thanks, and we'll talk to you in a future episode.
Thanks, everybody.